My name is Ross Mitchell. I'm from the University of Calgary, and kindly asked me to come today and talk to you about some of the work we're doing in time frequency analysis. So that's what I'm going to do. This is a paper being presented by myself and several of my graduate students. So a little bit about our group to start off with. Our group is the Imaging Informatics Group at the University of Calgary, and these are these 10 people form the core of the group. Our purpose in life, if you want, our mission statement really is to improve the diagnosis, treatment, and monitoring of disease through the application of information technology. And really, what we like to do is look for signatures and signals. So these folks here are all graduate students. The first three are research associates. And they come from a wide range of backgrounds: biochemistry, several comp sci, physics, radiology, applied math, and other physics. And I'm very fortunate that they have between them a very nice array of national level scholarships. The seven students have 14 national level scholarships between them. So a very bright group of folks. And they're the ones that are doing all the work, not me. Today this talk is so I'll start with a brief outline. I'm going to briefly introduce MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, which is a Fourier-based imaging modality. And then I'm going to talk about texture analysis of a particular type of brain tumor, and introduce that, talk about texture analysis, and talk about how we use the Stockwell transform in our lab to do texture analysis, and present some results from an ongoing experiment. Sorry. So how many people in here have had an MRI? Just a few, actually. Okay. How many people here have heard of MRI? Almost everybody's heard of MRI, right? And the wait times are usually a pretty hot political issue in most jurisdictions in Canada. MRI is a technique of producing maps of spinning protons inside the human body. And what's interesting about these protons is when you put them in a very strong magnetic field, and by strong we typically mean 30,000 times the strength of the Earth's background magnetic field. When you put somebody in a field or an object, a person, inside an MR field of that strength, the protons spin about an axis that is aligned with the direction of the magnetic field or against it, parallel or anti-parallel. And there's a net excess spinning in the direction of the magnetic field. And so if you just look at the object as a whole, you get a net magnetization. The object becomes magnetized with an orientation of that magnetization pointing down, in this case, down the bore of the magnet. So what you do, an interesting property of these is that they spin at a rate that's determined linearly in direct proportion with the strength of the magnetic field. So if you transmit a pulse of radio frequency energy into this steady state system at that frequency, the resonant frequency, it perturbs the system. And then over the next 5 to 6 seconds, it goes back into steady state, which is aligning. You get a net magnetization down the bore of the magnet. So you imagine you hit these spins with a pulse of radio frequency energy. It scatters them. They absorb that energy and scatter. And then over the next several seconds, they slowly come back into alignment, back to their steady state condition. And as they go back to their steady state condition, they induce a signal in an antenna that you put near the body part that you're interested in imaging. And that's MRI. What they do is they actually change the magnetic field slightly, parts per billion, over the distance of approximately a meter. And that causes the spins, the protons to resonate at slightly different frequencies depending on their spatial location. And that's how spatial information is encoded into the signal. But fundamentally, MRI is a process of measuring signal in the Fourier domain. We're measuring resonant frequencies. And then after we've completed measuring frequencies over spatial locations, we actually do an inverse Fourier transform to make the image. And often what we'll do is we'll take the magnitude. We'll almost always take the magnitude. So it's a real object, so the Fourier transform, or the Fourier representation of that object, you should have symmetry in that Fourier domain. And we more or less enforce that when we do the reconstruction by taking the magnitude. But there's lots of artifacts that happen in the MR domain because they consider it fundamentally to be a process of frequency and not of time frequency. And in my group, we fundamentally believe that this should be represented with something like a Stockwell type of formalism. So right now they'll assume that the patient doesn't move, the heart isn't beating, they aren't breathing, the chest wall isn't moving, and all sorts of things aren't happening, and that this acquisition of this frequency signal happens instantaneously. And we think that this should be described now using the Stockwell formalism. It's not. It's described with the classical Fourier formalism. The neat thing about the MR scanner and the focus of much of the work over the past decade is that you can program it. You can put in different kinds of RF pulses and you can change, apply local gradients and do all sorts of interesting things to the spins to tease out information. Unlike X-ray based modalities like computerized tomography that basically map the density of electrons, because it's primarily the electrons that interact with the photons that travel through the body in X-ray. In MR, you don't just get a map of the density. You can get maps that are weighted by the movement of water, the diffusion of water. Tissue biochemistry can perturb or change the local magnetic environment and change the spins. A good example is in CT of the head, white matter and gray matter, the two main tissues in the brain, look almost the same because they have almost the same density, but they have very different physical properties, and so their biochemical environment is different, and so they look very different in MRI. And that's one of the reasons why MRI has become so popular. So here's a typical type of image that you might get off of a modern MRI scanner. And these are images, they're called axial images, and they're cut, they're as if you cut the brain open this way, and so you pulled a slice out this way, horizontally, and these are just above the level of the eyes. And to point out a few sort of gross anatomical structures, this butterfly-shaped structure in the middle, those are called the ventricles, and they're filled with cerebrospinal fluid. And cerebrospinal fluid is a lot like blood plasma, but without all the heavy big proteins. And you can see this white stuff around the edge, that's also cerebrospinal fluid. So the brain is actually encased in a bag, and inside that bag is this CSF, and the CSF is there as a buffering agent. So when you smack your head up against the wall, your brain doesn't slam into your skull. And it also helps preserve the chemical environment of the brain. So the CSF is actually produced and in the ventricles, and it circulates throughout the brain. It has a very slow rate of circulation, nowhere near the order of circulation of the blood. But in this particular MR contrast, the fluid is bright. This is the same slice. So these two images are acquired approximately 40 milliseconds apart, so they're essentially aligned with each other. We programmed the scanner slightly differently or teased out different information, and here the fluid is dark. So one of the things that we do in signal processing is take advantage of this multi-contrast nature. For example, the noise here is largely uncorrelated with the noise, so at the very least you should be able to help use multiple images like this to reduce the effects of noise, but also you can pick out, you could say, ask an algorithm to find anything that's dark in this image and bright in this image, and it's going to find your CSF for you. So there's lots of things you can do. So that's a brief introduction to MRI, and I'm going to talk about its application in brain cancer, and I'll just talk about this brain cancer a little bit. So glioma, how many people in here have heard the term glioma before? God forbid you know anybody who's had one of these. You know, you're very fortunate if you don't know anybody who's had a glioma. So glial cells are support cells. They help support the neurons in the central nervous system and provide things like nutrition, physical support. They actually form a lot of the infrastructure that is used to support the physical structure of the brain. Some of them are involved in myelinating the axons. In fact, we'll talk about those ones in particular. So we tend to refer to these as the housekeeping cells of the brain. They aren't actually involved in the transmission or processing of signals. They're there to support the cells that do that. So gliomas are cancers that arise out of glial cells. So it's thought to be a stem cell in the brain, a stem cell originated type of cancer, and these stem cells are differentiating into glial cells uncontrollably, and it causes the growth of this tumor. They're rare, relatively rare tumors, but they're very fatal tumors. They're very, very deadly tumors. So even though don't occur very often, when they do occur, they tend to kill those who get them. And unfortunately, they represent a high percentage of the cancers that are present in children. And of course, the way they kill a person is hideous. Now, the unfortunate thing about this, we get 1,000 new cases each year in Canada, and here's what they look like. This is an autopsy, and you can see this invasive mass that's actually crossed the central line of the brain and come in. So the tumor actually started over here and it grew across. And this is what it looks like in an MRI when you get this sort of thing. So you hear the term, these things are graded into different stages. And the worst stage is called a glioblastoma multiforme, or a GBM. And those are very deadly. Typical lifespan from first diagnosis or first detection is less than 12 months. There's another kind called an oligodendroglioma. So it's a glioma. It's a glial cell tumor of the brain. And it comes from support cells called oligodendrocytes. And these cells actually create the myelin, which helps the transmission of impulses down nerves. Anyways, oligodendroglioma is a particular type of glioma that has a real dichotomy in outcome. So there are patients that have, they go in and actually take a bit of a tissue. They do a brain biopsy surgery, take a bit of tissue, and send that to the pathologist who stains it and looks at it under the microscope and makes the diagnosis of the tumor type. So patients will come back with the same tumor type and receive the same treatment, be it radiotherapy or chemotherapy, or usually a combination of both. And there's a subgroup of patients, approximately a quarter to a third of patients have this really bad prognosis, 95% mortality in 24 months. And there's another group that go on and have more or less a normal lifespan. And this, so these people are responding to therapy and these people aren't. And it really confused researchers for the longest time why this was, until a colleague of mine, who's the head of the Department of Clinical Neurosciences at the University of Calgary, he's actually the fellow who sorted this out, and he's very well known in the brain cancer field for this. He saw this all the time in the clinic, where he had two patients, same tumor, same treatment, one's dead within 12 months, and the second one's alive 10 years later. Why? Well, he discovered that it's due to a massive genetic deletion in the people who survive, and these are entire alleles in the chromosome, you know, thousands of genes we're talking about that are missing. And these are just in the tumor cells. The rest of the patient, the tissue in the patient is normal. But genetically, the cells that form the tumor are, well, the reason why they're tumors is because their genetics are abnormal. That's the main thought about cancer these days. But the reason these guys respond to a therapy is the genes involved in these alleles have subsequently been found to be involved in DNA maintenance and repair. So these cells lack the ability to fix their DNA when that DNA is damaged by chemo or radiotherapy. So the tumor responds to that, it shrinks and dies, and the patient lives. If these genetic components are intact, the tumor cells fight off the radio and chemotherapy, the tumor grows, and the patient dies. So it's a huge revolution in brain cancer treatment. It's now not enough just to go in and take a tissue sample and look at it under the microscope. You actually have to do the genetics. So here's an example. This is one patient in this top row and a second patient in the bottom row. And they, this white mass here is the tumor, the brain tumor. And you can see on this alternate MRI contrast, it's this dark mass here. And in this patient, it's a little harder to see, but this bright mass here, that's the tumor. You can see how big it is. And over here, you can see how it's slightly darker. That's the brain tumor there. So brain surgery is performed, tissue samples pulled out, sent to the path lab where the pathologist stains it and gets this supposedly, I'm told, classical fried egg appearance, and that indicates an oligodendroglioma. So the diagnosis comes back that you both have, in this case, a stage 2 or stage 3 oligodendroglioma. And they would be treated identically. But now they would actually take that and go on and do a Western blot. And you can see that there's material missing here that's present up here. They have a control strip here as well. So this tumor lacks the ability to repair itself when it's attacked with radiotherapy and chemotherapy. This patient down here survived, and this patient up here died. And it's really a binary decision, it appears. If your blot comes out like this, they're going to go after your tumor aggressively. And if it comes out like this, they tell you to get your affairs in order. So you've got about 12 months to live, typically. So one of the drawbacks of this system is that they only ever do a biopsy once. Even if they'll go in and biopsy something like this and go and remove it surgically and then treat it with chemo and radiotherapy, the tumor will grow back. It's been shown that if you treat this aggressively, you cut it out and do the chemo and the radio, you extend life by an average of 2 to 4 weeks on typically. But you're only giving the patient an extra month of life. So these things grow back, but even when they grow back, they don't re-biopsy them. They just go by that one initial diagnosis. So it would be very nice to have a non-invasive way of imaging these tumors and sorting out their genetics. And if I hadn't shown you this and I had asked you, which of these two tumors do you think is worse, if you just had to eyeball them, most people would say this one down here, because it's more diffuse and infiltrative and penetrating, and it looks like it's a worse tumor. This one has a pretty clear margin. You can imagine a surgeon going in there and cutting that out, right, or putting a radiotherapy dose volume around that and treating it. But this is very diffuse. But it turns out the opposite is true. These are the ones that respond to therapy, and these are the ones that tend not to. So Dr. Cairncross came to me one day, and he said, they play a game where they put the MR scans up, and they look at them, and they try and guess the genetics based on the appearance of the MRI. They're not very good at it, and they actually did a study, and they didn't get very good sensitivity or specificity from radiologists looking at the tumors. So he came to me and said, and that study was qualitative, and they're looking for things like a diffuse border and a heterogeneous composition of the lesion. So he came to me and said, do you have anything quantitative that can measure patterns and images? And I said, yeah, we call that texture, and we happen to have this new tool that we think is really good for measuring texture. And that tool is a Stockwell transform. But before we get there, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about texture analysis and show you, run you through sort of state-of-the-art of texture analysis in medical imaging. So we all sort of intuitively know what image texture means. It's hard to describe quantitatively many times. Like, we can all see the different textures, these different patterns of intensity, and you can describe them in a variety of different ways. But the goal in medical image processing is to use texture. So here's a single channel grayscale image. And when we look at this, we can easily break that up into images. But you want the computer to be able to do that. You want it to be able to do something like this. You want it to be able to label those regions based on the patterns of their intensities. Then, for example, we could measure the volume of this structure here. And if that were a tumor, we could treat it and see if it grows or shrinks. All kinds of useful things you can do. The most common method that's been in use for the last 20-25 years is based on analysis of what's called a co-occurrence matrix, and it's basically a statistical technique looking at patterns. One of the limitations of the co-occurrence matrix is that it can, for all effective purposes, it can only look at adjacent pixels. So what I've done is I've taken an image and I've zoomed it up to the level of the pixel. And I'm showing you two different spatial locations in this image, and these are 2x2 pixel regions, and I want you to play the role of classification algorithm for a moment for me, please. And I want you to tell me, are these two locations part of the same macromolecular or macro structure in the image? Yes or no? Who thinks that these are both part of the same region in the image, the same structure? How many people think, no way, those aren't. These are totally different areas in the image. And how many people aren't sure? Yeah, I think you're right. So what I'm going to do is the problem is you just don't have enough information. These are literally the same patterns, and they're just, you know, tens of pixels apart in this image. It's hard to tell if they're part of the same region or not. So I'm going to give you information at a broader spatial scale. So I'm giving you very high frequency information because it's local. I'm going to give you some more low frequency information. Now I'm going to ask you the same question. With more spatial information at a different scale, are these part of the same region now or not? How many people think they are part of the same region? Oh, and how many people think they aren't? More people think they aren't. Okay, well, I'm going to introduce information at a broader spatial scale. Now what do you think? Because look at this out here. Now do you think they're part of the same region or not? How many people think they are part of the same region? And how many people think they aren't? Only a few diehards. Okay, now I'm going to introduce information at a broader spatial scale. Now what do you think? And here I'm going to show you the whole image. No, the answer is they are not part of the same image. You can see there's this structure here, and then there's this structure here, and they're very different. So the spatial scale that we consider texture at is, of course, critically important, and yet for the past 25 years, all we've really done is look at this. And sometimes this works, because there are differences at this spatial scale, but not always. In fact, most of the time it doesn't work. And in fact, in brain cancer, this technique has been used and found to have very little value whatsoever. So, on to the Stockwell transform, and we know about its multi-scale properties. And this, you know, when I describe this to docs or to physicists even, they're very familiar with Fourier analysis because all of modern medical imaging is built upon Fourier analysis, but they don't know much about wavelets. You ask them about wavelets, and they don't know much about it. And there's a real communication issue. And so I just say, well, we use wavelets every day. Every time you go home on the bus listening to your iPod, you're listening to a wavelet. And they appreciate that. So the Stockwell transform, of course, gives us this nice multi-scaling feature here. And I'm not going to go through the mathematics too much because, of course, we've seen this a lot over the last couple of days. But the, you know, the key factor is the transform of the signal times the image. And we have, the Gaussian with the frequency in it, so we have the frequency adapted to combine the properties of the wavelets, or perhaps the Stockwell transform is a wavelet. And this nice criteria, this nice characteristic of the window, so that we can integrate along the time axis of our time frequency domain and exactly recover our Fourier spectra. And this is really important for medical imaging, because all the machinery that exists out there to handle medical image signals works in this domain right here. So what this means is we could measure a signal off of our MR scanner, for example, go over to the Stockwell domain and start doing filtering based on time and or frequency, then come back to the Fourier domain and carry on with all the machinery that's already in place to process these signals. And that's hugely important, that it fits so well. So, of course, the classical limitation of the Fourier spectrum is that it doesn't tell you when things happen. Stockwell domain does, and the brute force way of building this up is to pick a point in this domain, use those two pieces of information, time and frequency, to tell you where and how big to apply your Gaussian window, pull that out, do a Fourier transform, take the result of that integral and plop it back there. Now, there's smarter ways to calculate it, of course. And as you go up in frequency, your Gaussian gets smaller. And this is typically how most people actually do the calculation. They implement it as a convolution in a Fourier domain for speed purposes. But even still, this can take a long time to calculate. So we published a paper a couple of years ago about distributing this on a cluster. And we can get the calculation down to, it's on the order of 30 seconds for a 512 squared image. But the problem is it still produces like 32 gigabytes of data for a full representation of the Stockwell domain. So you have these huge storage and computational issues. So what do these look like? And this is more review. I mean, for the people who may not be too familiar, this is what a delta looks like. So here's the signal in time. Here's the same signal transformed to the Fourier domain. And the time frequency representation looks like this. And one of the neat properties, of course, is that you can see the uncertainty principle at work here. We get this trade-off between temporal resolution and frequency resolution as you move through this. So the DC components down here, of course, exist everywhere in time. And that's very useful because in medicine, a lot of our signals are low frequency and they exist for long periods of duration, like breathing. It's a very low frequency signal, but it exists the whole time the patient is being imaged. Whereas functional activation in a functional MRI scan is very short, high frequency bursts. So in biology, there already is a lot of natural separation in frequency and time. And I think this is uniquely, very nicely suited for sorting out a lot of biological signals. Here's a carrier wave with some information on top of it. And you can easily see the carrier and the information on top of it. And there's just two sine waves in the Fourier spectrum. And of course, in imaging, we always have noise. It's almost, even when you put a patient in a scanner, just thermal noise in the body, or preferably electronic noise in your system, comes to dominate the noise sources. So you always have to look at noise. And if your noise has the appropriate frequency content, you can see it here in this type of a representation. So there's the high frequency noise that's corrupting this signal, and it corresponds, of course, to specific regions. So you can go in there and edit this out, collapse it back, and reconstruct your signal. One of the key things in signal processing is being able to see it so you can do something about it. We've actually done this and compared it to some traditional filters that are used in medical imaging. And the Stockwell filter vastly outperforms a lot of, like, this is a very, very popular filter that's used a lot. It's a spatially based filter. And it's neat because as they make the filters perform better and better, they get closer and closer to what the Stockwell transform is doing, this sort of time frequency based filter. And you can see how it's maintaining. I hit the wrong button there. No, no, it's the monitor. It's set to a different input. There it is. Okay, we're good. you can see how it's maintaining the amplitude of the signals here. You get a bit of attenuation. So those things can be really important. Even when you have a lot of high power noise, where the power of the noise is vastly greater than the power of the signal, if it's separated in time or space, you can get at it. So here, the corrupted signal, it does not a bad job of reconstructing and faithfully reconstructs the power of some of these high frequency components, which is very important. So skip over that. Here's an example. This is work that was done with Rob Pinnaker. An epilepsy waveform measured in a period between two seizures in a patient. And what the neurologists actually do, they look for waveforms or patterns inside this frequency and use that to help them determine how they're going to treat the patient. So in this case, the goal is to look for a waveform that starts at around 10 hertz and drops in frequency to somewhere around 8 hertz and increases in power. And to do this right now, believe it or not, they count zero crossings. And that's how they get estimates of the frequency content of this signal changing over time. So this can take 20 minutes to analyze this waveform to try and determine if the pattern is there. So we're suggesting that they do something like this instead, which takes about that long to calculate. And then you can clearly see and just print that off and include it in the patient charts. And you can imagine that this, I would imagine, be of great interest to epileptologists, because now they can do a lot more patients in one day. And of course, they get paid per read, not per time, right? Their revenue could go up a lot. Rob Pinnaker and his comrades at Calgary Scientific are extending this to 2D to look at for patterns and seismic signals and voice images and whatnot, and getting some very interesting results with that. But our application in my lab, and this project in particular, is to use the 2D Stockwell transform to look at patterns and images. So what does it give you? Basically gives you a complete Fourier description centered around each pixel. And a lot of MR people have trouble with this. They say, well, there's one Fourier transform, one Fourier domain. We actually fill this up in the MR scanner row by row typically, and then we inverse transform it to get this image. How can you tell me that there's a Fourier domain for that pixel? And of course, if you think about it intuitively, how can you say that the frequency content here in this relatively homogeneous region is the same as it would be down here, where you see a clear sine wave in the vertical direction, vertical orientation? There's clearly a different frequency content here than there is there. So really in MR, we're measuring the bulk average, and the Stockwell transform lets us take this bulk average and now split it into its constituent parts and look at them. But it's a lot of data. So you get a 256 squared image, and you get a 256 squared Fourier domain for each of those. It adds up a lot. So the key is to collapse it down. And so we do what others have done, is to integrate this domain in rings to collapse it from a two-dimensional signal down to a one-dimensional signal. And I describe this as a texture curve to my clinical colleagues, and they sort of get that. Because remember, the physicians, they don't know what a Fourier transform is. So you have to sort of come up with literature to bridge that divide. And we don't know a lot of the terminology that they use when they're describing the genetics and the drugs and the pathophysiology of the tumor. So that's a lot of what we're doing, is by being in the hospitals trying to bridge this gap. But so what you have here is you have information about the power at various spatial frequencies. What you lack is information on orientation, and you lack information on the phase. But that's probably okay, at least for this application. Those are probably two good things to sacrifice. So this is the spatial scale from the DC for the whole region around the tumor right up to the adjacent pixels. So we're looking at all spatial scales simultaneously here. And so what we did is we put this in these two extreme examples. These two patients sort of represent the extremes of the patterns that you see in these brain tumors. And when we put an ROI down in the most homogeneous appearing region of each of these lesions, and we got vastly different local frequency spectra. So we got really excited about this. And actually, when this sort of thing happens, we say the fireworks go off in medical imaging. We'll make the fireworks go off. There we go. So there we go. And you get really excited about this stuff. You say, wow, this is really cool. So we wanted to try it out in a larger patient size. So that's, I'm just going to show you the results from this ongoing experiment. So this is This is a hypothesis that basically underlines this experiment, that genetic damage at the level of the chromosome could cause a phenotypical or a structural change in MRI at a vastly, vastly different spatial scale. MRI, our voxels are typically on the order of a millimeter cubed. That's actually pretty good. Some of them are a lot bigger than a millimeter cubed. So genetic damage on the scale of, you know, inside a cell, a big cell is 20 microns. And I was really skeptical about this. I didn't think that genetic damages would, or a change, in genetic change would cause a change in MRI at a spatial scale in the order of millimeters. And that, of course, that we could use something like ST-based texture to detect this. So we did a retrospective study of 45 patients who'd been through the clinic in Calgary, Alberta, and had biopsy-confirmed low-grade oligodendrogliomas, 28 men, 17 women, median age of 43 years. Roughly half of these patients had the genetic deletion, and so they responded well to therapy, and the other half had intact genetics. And so another entry criteria is that they had to have had MRI, and this is a very common protocol. When someone comes in and they have seizures, and they're examined neurologically, they'll send them for an MRI, and then they'll get the typically all three of these different types of MR contrast. Doesn't matter so much what they are, but they had to have had at least two out of these three, and most of them had all three. So then we decided to look at the local spatial frequency content in these tumors. And this is a more typical case that you might see in the clinic, where a patient comes in, presents with seizures, and is examined, and a suspected brain tumor is involved, and they're sent for MRI, and they get back a scan that looks like this. So these are two different people, and one of these patients, when they did the biopsy and ran the Western blot, actually was discovered to have deleted or damaged genetics, and one of them, the genetics was intact. So one of these patients is going to live, and one of them is going to die. Who thinks, which is which? Let me ask you, take a good close look at the images and see if you can predict. How many people think this one is the one who's going to respond to therapy? A couple people. How many people think this one is going to respond to therapy? And how many people aren't sure? Yeah, most people aren't sure. So this image is called a T2 weighted image, and that's important. I'll get back to that in a minute. I'll bring it up in a second. So it turns out that this person actually has the deletion of the alleles and will respond to therapy and will live. So what we did is we took these examples, and we actually had to carve out a sub-region of the image because the current ST is still too much data. So we placed a sub-image that spanned the region of the tumor plus some normal appearing tissue, especially in the contralateral hemisphere. And then inside that, we placed another region of interest, a large region of interest, to sort of maximally inscribe within the tumor region, and we calculated a single local spatial frequency curve for this entire large ROI. So we're getting one curve per tumor. We could actually do one per pixel if we wanted to, but at least in this initial pass, to get the benefits of averaging for signal to noise, we're doing one big region inside the tumor. So the first MR contrast that the patients had, T1 weighted, this is sort of what we found. The red line is the patients with the intact genetics who are not going to respond to therapy. So the red is the non-responders, and the blue are the responders. Just think, so blue is good. And you can see that the local spatial frequency content is very similar. The blue band represents where these two curves are different at the P.05 level. Interesting. Interesting result. But when we looked at this next MRI contrast, things got a lot more interesting, because there's much better separation between these curves over a much broader range of spatial frequencies. But as when we looked at the last, which is the T2 weighted scan, and this is the scan I just asked you to look at a minute ago, and most people, when they look at it, have a hard time sorting out the genetics. But when you look at it with local spatial frequency content, you get really nice separation between the curves over quite a broad range. And I think that part of what's going on here is human beings are good sort of at large scale, down at the low spatial frequencies. And when we zoom the image up and look at it at sort of the pixel level, we're good somewhere up here until the beat frequency of the pixels themselves starts to interfere with our ability to detect patterns. But I think we're sort of good at both ends of this range, and we're kind of crummy in the middle. So to sort of confirm that, well, we looked at these and did ROC analysis, which I'm not going to go into, but it's a way of determining the diagnostic efficiency of a test. And because we knew the truth, we could go in and have look at the frequency content and have an algorithm make a prediction. Are the genetics intact or deleted? And then we could go look up and find out whether we got it right or not and determine our accuracy. And you can also determine sensitivity and specificity. So for the first MR contrast, and we're just looking at one frequency component, that's all, just very, very simple, simple. We got an accuracy of 73% sorting out the genetics. The next contrast went up a little bit, up to 76%, but the T2 weighted scan that I had you look at, we're up close to 90%, and this is just one frequency component. So the next stage, well, in a minute, we'll try and improve this through various techniques, but we're already up to 86% doing sort of the dumbest thing. So we asked radiologists to look at the data and try and sort it out using the criteria of heterogeneity, diffuse border, and ask them to try and make predictions. So here's the radiologist's performance in terms of sensitivity, specificity, positive and negative predictive value, which are critical ways to characterize any diagnostic test. And you can see just using one frequency component and one MR contrast, we're vastly outperforming the neuroradiologists who looked at these scans. And when you get sensitivities and specificities up in the 90% range, that's a very powerful diagnostic test. And we're pretty sure that by combining information from multiple images and using multiple frequency components to do something as simply as just vote, so we have multiple frequencies and have them vote on what they think the genetics are, that will help make us more immune to noise, we'll be able to get these numbers up even higher. So, quite a surprise to me. I didn't expect to see this at all, but it's pretty clear that the texture analysis is seeing something that the radiologist is not in these scans. We're quite excited about that. So future work. I presented these results at the Alberta Cancer Board annual research meeting about a month ago, and generated a tremendous amount of excitement. And so we're going to try and use more available information. This is more for the cancer guys. We're going to look at more aggressive grades of these brain tumors. And the neat thing is there's a lot of people studying the genetics, and these refer to different genes that may be turned on or turned off or altered in the cancer process. And there's all kinds of reasons to believe that these things are critical in determining whether a tumor is going to respond or not. But they may also have a side effect of changing sort of the macro molecular patterns inside the image that might be detectable with this technology. And of course, after I gave this presentation, people are interested in, for example, applying this to other types of cancers. And right now, prostate tumors are a huge issue because we have very sensitive tests to determine if there's something wrong with the prostate, like the PSA level. But your PSA levels can go up if you have a relatively benign urinary tract infection. And yet, if you go in and have one of these tests, the doctor's going to send you off probably to get a biopsy, and a lot of men will just opt to have the whole thing taken out if they're elderly. But that can cause all kinds of problems. There's all kinds of side effects that happen when you have these biopsies or you have the surgery. Cervical cancer, a group at the Tom Baker Cancer Clinic in Calgary contacted me after they saw the talk. There's a P53 mutation that leads to a very aggressive subtype of cervical cancer, and these patients have a very poor outcome. There's, you know, high mortality at 12 months. And when talking to the pathologist, he says, you know, when he looks at it under the microscope at a large scale, he can see different patterns, and he knows even before he gets down to the cellular level that it's this P53 mutation because he can see it at a sort of a tissue scale. So we're quite interested in looking at that. So that basically is a brief introduction. What we'd like to be able to do, I'm going to go back for a sec here. One of the reasons we're right here. So right now it takes a long time to calculate this. We're working on ways to calculate these curves much more rapidly, and it's our belief that at some time in the future, radiology viewing workstations could have this technology incorporated directly into them so that the radiologist could put down or click on a pixel or specify a small ROI and get this a local frequency curve come up. And it's like a form of spectroscopy for them. And that we could then use this to form hypotheses and drive other sort of prospective experiments to validate this in patient groups. But ultimately, if you can imagine being able to plop this down inside any region, it would help cue the human observers to what types of patterns are happening. So if we can calculate the Stockwell transform quickly via a fast wavelet transform, it could have absolutely enormous implications on health. So one of the, we showed this at the Radiological Society of North America. It's a big meeting that's held at the end of November each year in Chicago, and it's the largest medical conference in the world. We had an attendance of about 70,000 at that meeting, and it's all trade show. It's millions and millions of dollars spent trying to sell medical imaging equipment. A fellow came by after he saw our demonstration and said he'd like to do this because the flow patterns in arteries, in the coronary arteries in the heart and the carotid arteries in the neck, are altered depending on whether the plaque is likely to rupture or not. That's a hypothesis that a lot of people have been studying for a number of years. Well, if you could use this type of texture analysis to analyze flow patterns and be able to tie that to a heart attack or a stroke in the future, it would be immensely, immensely, it would have the impact of billions of dollars per year on the healthcare system. No exaggeration. Because those rupturing of the arteries in the heart or in the carotid artery is still the number one killer of North Americans, of people in the West. Over half of all people die because one of those arteries ruptures. So if you can have a way of predicting that ahead of time, it would really change the way healthcare is practiced. So we're really interested in fast Stockwell transforms and any other kind of technology that we can use to analyze signatures or images like this. And with that, I'll take questions. Thanks very much.